NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump has offered shifting goals for the war with Iran. We talk about the rising political risk. And the pastor of a historic church in Tulsa says the black church can offer an alternative to rising Christian nationalism.
There is a generation that's trying to decide, I love Jesus, but I don't want that Jesus. And I think the African-American church has an opportunity to represent Jesus in such a way that Jesus is not tied to some political party or some political ideology.
And there's always the puzzle. It's Sunday, March 8th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. North Star Student is a new series from KAXE where we recognize Northern Minnesota students for their athletic accomplishments, artistic endeavors, academic achievements, or other efforts. Our second ever North Star student is Staples Motley junior Ronnie Noska. She is ranked as one of the top tennis players in the state. She's a four-time state qualifier, including a fourth-place finish in doubles and two consolation runners-up in singles. Noska was nominated by her coach, Nikki Paskowitz, because of her amazing career and the fact that she's got one more season full of fun and achievement ahead of her. I spoke with Noska and Paskowitz, starting with how Noska got her start on the court.
I think I started playing tennis practically when I started to be able to walk. My mom has six other siblings, and all other five of those siblings play tennis. My grandpa was a big role in it. He actually just passed away this last winter, so it was a little weird not having him there. But I started playing junior high in like fourth grade, fifth grade, like whenever I could. I had a lot of friends on the varsity team.
What makes you passionate about tennis?
I've always been like a very hard worker, and tennis isn't something that will come easy to really anybody, even if you're super talented. So just the competition with yourself, not even like competing with other people, but like the mental clarity you get from exercising and just like the competition you have with yourself. And like, it's something that you can always work at 100% at.
How have you seen Ronnie grow in all the years, whether from little, from tennis camps, or maybe when you started coaching, how has she grown and changed over that time?
I think she's grown in just like taking pressure off of herself. I think that's something she puts a lot of pressure on herself in like areas of life to like be her best. And I think her just being able to like take a step back and like find joy in the things that she's pushing herself in and like doing it for herself has been really fun to watch.
Beyond tennis, what else are you involved in? What else should people know about you?
I hunt all the time. I duck hunt, goose hunt, grouse, pheasant, all fall long, which is hard because of tennis. I can't get out there all the time, but I think I missed three mornings all duck season up until deer hunting. And obviously like sections in state I had to miss. I deer hunt, turkey hunt. That's basically the biggest thing that I do is I hang out with my friends and cousins and we all go hunting together. And
well, are there any hunting memories or accomplishments you want to brag about too?
Not really. I mean, I think this year my family has access to a private lake and we limit it out almost every day for a couple weeks there. I did end up halfway through having about 8 hours of homework to do. So we slept in the canoe overnight and at 3 a.m. I was on my Chromebook or my MacBook doing my homework out in the lake. And my cousins are like, are you like, seriously, you're doing your homework now? I'm like, I need to turn it in.
Ronnie's also really smart. We've got a really smart team, but I think that should be highlighted.
The last kind of tie a bow on it question I wanted to ask you, Nikki, is just why nominate Ronnie? Why does she deserve to be recognized?
I think it's just like fun to see, like you said, just someone who's like not like your normal like tennis player, like have so much success in it. And just like the way we ended our year as a team and like her as an individual, I'm really excited like for what's coming for her and for our team too. And so I just like thought she was a really good fit for it. She just works really hard and has for a really long time. And And I think just getting excited for what's to come too. So yeah, highlighting what's happened and then also like getting excited for what's coming too.
That was Staples Motley tennis coach Nikki Paskowitz and junior Ronnie Noska, KAXE's North Star student. If you know of a North Star student in your area, you can nominate them at kaxe.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning, and thank you for being here with us today. It's been just over a week since Israel and the U.S. began bombing Iran. And as the conflict expands to include over half of the countries in the Middle East, the reasons and objectives for that war remain murky, even as Iranian officials are poised to announce a new supreme leader. President Trump says he's considering choosing the new leader. But in speaking in the Oval Office last week, he said that it might not work out.
I guess the worst case would be we do this and then somebody takes over who's as bad as the previous person, right? That could happen. We don't want that to happen. It would probably be the worst. You go through this and then in 5 years you realize you put somebody in who is no better.
We're joined now by senior national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning.
So, you know, as we just heard, regime change in Iran might not work out. Do we have a better understanding of why the U.S. is bombing Iran alongside Israel and what the objectives of this war are?
I think the military objectives are pretty clear. The administration says it wants to destroy Iran's navy. It wants to set back their ballistic missile program. But the political objectives are more confusing, and they've been shifting. The president has said he wants unconditional surrender. He says he wants to have a say in picking the next leader. He said that the Venezuelan model is perfect. In other words, where you leave the regime in place, but you just change the leader. Kind of the band is still playing, but the lead singer gets replaced. But Israel might want the collapse of the entire regime. And this all raises the big question that if it is regime change that the U.S. wants, how do you do that with air power alone? There's never been a case where regime change has happened just through bombing from the air.
So President Trump has also been talking about taking over Cuba. What's the strategy there?
Well, I think the short answer is that Cuba is weak. Trump is emboldened. He has said that Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in talks with Cuban leadership and that a deal could be made, quote, very fast. He's also said that Cuba is in its, quote, last months of life. Cuba, like Venezuela, is a small, weak country in the United States' backyard. It's the subject of an oil blockade right now, and its economy is close to collapsing. But that's not nearly as risky as what the president is doing in Iran. You know, he's taking a big risk. He went to war without the support of the American people. 40% of Americans tell pollsters they are supportive of this war, and that's very low. He didn't get the kind of rally around the flag effect that presidents usually get when they start a war. He has said, quote, I don't care about polling. I just have to do the right thing. And the president is also facing a lot of other headwinds right now. February jobs numbers showed that the U.S. economy lost 92,000 jobs in February. Gas prices are going up, and if the Iran war continues, they'll probably stay there. Stock market is dropping. And in all of these special elections that we've had, the Democrats, despite having historic lows in popularity for their party, Democratic candidates keep on winning.
The president's immigration policy was in the spotlight again this week after he fired Department of Homeland Security head Kristi Noem. Will that turn things around on that issue for him?
Well, I don't think so unless the ICE policies remain the same. You know, Kristi Noem presided over those botched ICE raids in Minnesota that left two American citizens dead. But you could argue that her biggest political misstep was when she claimed that the president himself had approved her $200 million ad campaign, which featured her prominently, sometimes on horseback or in a cowboy hat or next to Mount Rushmore or in front of incarcerated inmates, immigrants. President Trump said he didn't approve that campaign and Noem was fired. So she is the first big casualty of the loss of support for Trump's immigration policies, which used to be his most popular policies. And she's been replaced now by Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen.
On Wednesday, lawmakers approved a subpoena for Attorney General Pam Bondi. They want to ask her about redactions in files related to sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, as well as why some documents were excluded. What are you watching for there?
I would be watching for new information about Trump's relationship with Epstein, but I think it's very unlikely that Pam Bondi or the Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, who's also volunteered to testify, will share any new information about that. But still, Epstein remains a very high concern for Republican base voters. MAGA really cares about this, and I don't think it's going away.
Meanwhile, there's a two-way Texas GOP primary coming up in May, and that'll determine who state Representative James Tallarico, who just beat U.S. Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, will face. Has President Trump endorsed anyone yet?
No, he says he will endorse in that primary runoff, conventional wisdom is that he's going to endorse the incumbent senator, John Cornyn. He's an establishment Republican who has been a Trump critic in the past, but many Republicans feel he would be the most electable. Trump has said that he wants the person he doesn't endorse to drop out of the race after he does that. And it remains to be seen if Ken Paxton, who's the attorney general and Cornyn's opponent, will do that.
That's NPR's Mara Liasson. Thank you so much, Mara.
Thank you.
Lebanon finds itself in the crossfire of the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran. Israel intensified its bombing campaign in South Lebanon after the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah launched rockets at it earlier last week. The Lebanese government says the war has displaced more than 100,000 people and killed nearly 300. Hezbollah enjoys wide popularity in Lebanon, but as NPR's Hadil Al-Shawchi reports, frustrations are mounting.
Okay, but when the bomb.
He points to a mattress that belonged to his receptionist.
Did you see the blood here?
She was in the room at the time of the attack and died a day later. Shibli says he doesn't want to talk politics, but he's tired of Lebanon being helpless and not having control over its own affairs.
We are a small country, and when we get our orders from outside...
He shrugs and doesn't want to elaborate, but orders from outside in Lebanon means being told what to do by other countries, including Iran. For decades, Iran has funded the militant group Hezbollah, which has now dragged Lebanon into another war Lebanese leaders say it can't afford. For decades, Hezbollah has been seen by many Lebanese as a resistance movement to fend off Israeli aggression and occupation in the south. Today, the Lebanese government is trying to distance itself from Hezbollah, as Iran itself is now under attack from Israel and the U.S. One man at the forefront of this push to rid Lebanon of Hezbollah is Justice Minister Adel Nassar. In an unprecedented move, the minister instructed security authorities to issue arrest warrants for those who launched the rockets at Israel last week.
Unfortunately, they gave this pretext to Israel. Although we condemn without any reservation the reaction of Israel, it remains that we have a major problem with Hezbollah.
Also, for the first time, the minister has proposed to charge Hezbollah's leader, Naeem Qassem, with, quote, dragging Lebanon into war and tampering with security. It's the sharpest rebuke any Lebanese government official has made against Hezbollah. Even in its own stronghold, patience is wearing thin with the militant group. That's a mayor from a town in southern Lebanon. The region where Hezbollah was founded runs its military and offers civil services like health care and education. He doesn't want us to use his name because he's afraid of repercussions for speaking out about politics. The mayor says even his own community was shocked and angry when Hezbollah launched rockets at Israel this time. He believes Hezbollah should only act in defense. We won't accept Hezbollah's decision to avenge the Iranian supreme leader's death or be in solidarity with Iran, he says. The mayor says the group didn't think about the consequences for their own people and Lebanon's people overall. This mayor is among tens of thousands of Lebanese who are now displaced. Many are forced to sleep on the streets, huddled in makeshift tents. Iran gives at least $700 million annually to Hezbollah in Lebanon, according to the U.S. State Department. And this mayor says that means Iran calls the shots. If Hezbollah didn't get involved in this battle, the Iranians will say, what use are they to us, he says. But being at war with Israel for years, the mayor says those in the south have no other choice but to look to Hezbollah for defense. The resistance, meaning Hezbollah, has become a necessity and a burden on the south, the mayor says. The Lebanese government recently banned all Hezbollah military activity, but Lebanese political analyst Ali Rizq says it's just paying lip service to the U.S.
to prove themselves to the Americans. But as you see, the rockets and missiles are still being fired from South Lebanon. So the Lebanese state can only do so much. It remains outgunned by Hezbollah.
And until real solutions are found, hotel owner George Shibley says it's people like him who will continue to suffer. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Beirut.
You're listening to NPR News.
Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Iran continues to fire drones and missiles into multiple Gulf states, damaging a desalinization plant in Bahrain. Saudi Arabia says it intercepted drones aimed at its Sheba oil field. Dubai International Airport halted flights after alerts and blasts. Israeli fighter jets continue to pound targets in Iran's capital, including oil storage facilities. They're also hitting Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. A federal judge has ruled the acting CEO of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, Carrie Lake, was not elevated to that job legitimately, and that her actions were undertaken without authority, including mass layoffs at Voice of America. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made In Cookware. Made In Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, for 35 years, sharing what works in schools today and working to inspire new ways to learn tomorrow. More at edutopia.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. What is it like getting caught in the Department of Homeland Security's surveillance web? NPR has collected dozens of accounts from people who have experienced just that. Together, they paint a picture of the broad tools that DHS, and more specifically ICE, is using to monitor and apprehend the people it seeks to deport and intimidate U.S. citizens critical of its policies. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has more.
On an evening in late January, Emily was driving through her Minneapolis neighborhood patrolling for Immigration Enforcement, or ICE. NPR is only identifying Emily by her first name because she fears retribution from the federal government. She followed an ICE vehicle at a safe distance into a parking lot.
And then someone leaned out of the passenger side of that SUV and took a picture of me and my car.
The SUV made a sudden U-turn and barreled towards her, braking right next to her car. And then a masked agent rolled down the window and addressed Emily by name.
And she yelled, "Emily, Emily, we're going to take you home." Then she looked at her phone and she recited my home address.
Emily said she's not sure how the agents pulled up her information so quickly, but it left her shaken.
Their message was not subtle, right? They were, in effect, saying, "We see you. We can get to you whenever we want to." And it did scare me.
NPR collected dozens of accounts through both interviews and court documents and found many similar experiences from protesters, immigrants, and journalists.
You know, we talk a lot about the Constitution and about what the Founding Fathers would have wanted.
Syra Hussein is a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a nonpartisan nonprofit focused on defending civil liberties in the digital world.
And I think that when you look at our ever-present surveillance state and the ways in which people are being retaliated against and identified, I think that this is exactly what they wouldn't have wanted.
DHS says its use of this technology falls within the law. ICE's budget has skyrocketed during President Trump's second term and has, in part, been used to purchase an array of surveillance tools and tech contracts. And the Trump administration has been aggregating Americans' personal data and making it more accessible to ICE. It remains unclear exactly how federal agents are using that data or what they're doing with photographs they take of protesters' faces. In January, a protester in Portland, Maine, named Colleen Fagan, was taking video of federal agents when one of them appeared to start recording her and photographing her license plate.
Yeah, why are you taking my information down?
Because we have a nice little database.
Oh, good.
And now you're considered a domestic terrorist, so...
DHS has repeatedly denied that such a database exists. The agency did not respond to a question from NPR about why its agents are taking photos of observers. Instead, it said in a statement that DHS, quote, will not reveal law enforcement methods or tactics.
Part of what's so pernicious about it is that people don't know what's going on.
Nathan Wessler is the deputy director of the Speech Privacy and Technology Project at the ACLU.
Nobody should have to wonder if they're merely being intimidated or actually, you know, being subjected to an invasive biometric scan. That's really just incredibly corrosive in what is supposed to be a free and open society.
We do know that federal immigration agents are using facial recognition software and location technology to find immigrants they seek to deport. The web of surveillance by DHS extends to social media, too.
I was just opening my email and I saw this letter.
Sherman Austin runs an Instagram account called Stop ICE Net.
I thought at first, is this like a scam or is this some kind of phishing thing going on?
Back in September, he received an email from Meta, the parent company of Instagram and Facebook, informing him that law enforcement was seeking information on his account. Austin was able to get a heavily redacted copy of an administrative subpoena sent to Meta, issued by DHS.
DHS has expanded its practice of using administrative subpoenas.
Steve Loney is an attorney with the ACLU of Pennsylvania, which has represented several people who have had their online information subpoenaed this way.
The pattern appears to be as soon as people become vocal critics of what's happening in immigration enforcement, they get an email from their social media company that says the government has requested your data.
Such subpoenas can be issued by federal agencies without a judge or a grand jury. Privacy and civil rights experts say they're being used to threaten free speech. Just days before Austin received that email from Meta, he had shared a post on Instagram that identified an ICE agent all through publicly available information. The reason DHS listed for his subpoena was, quote, officer safety and doxing.
Which I thought was funny, because how can you dox someone if they've already made their information public?
Austin asked a federal court to block the subpoena. DHS withdrew it several weeks later, which Loney says is also part of the pattern. Austin is very public about running his account, but Loney says many of these administrative subpoenas are meant to unmask anonymous accounts critical of ICE, which he says is unconstitutional.
The ability to criticize the government anonymously is baked into our First Amendment rights.
And that anonymity is becoming increasingly difficult to preserve. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
With the time change last night, some of us are probably waking up a little groggy. But it may be especially bad for many teenagers who are getting less sleep than ever, according to a new study. Here's reporter Ari Daniel with the latest, including a few tips.
Let's face it, teenagers need their rest.
Sleep plays a crucial role in adolescent brain development. It's important for emotional regulation in teenagers and important for their overall physical and mental health.
Tanner Boomersbach is a child and adolescent psychiatrist at the University of Wisconsin. He says teens are sleeping less now than they used to, but he and his colleagues wanted to know if that loss of sleep has impacted certain groups of adolescents disproportionately. So they analyzed survey data to look for any trends in teen sleep.
Over 120,000 high school students were included in the sample, so representative of the entire nation as a whole.
Bottom line, things have gotten worse for teens across all demographics. Roughly 3 out of 4 American adolescents reported getting less than 8 hours of sleep in 2023, up since 2007. And a growing number of kids are getting 5 hours or less. These changes didn't appear to depend on certain risk behaviors.
Regardless of mental health symptoms, substance use, how many hours a day they're watching TV or they're on social media, we saw widespread increases in insufficient sleep across the population.
Boomersbach speculates earlier school start times might be driving this, or maybe too many extracurricular demands or less parental monitoring. Regardless, he worries about its impact on teenage mental health and school performance. The results appear in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
This is definitely a highly prevalent problem, and it's an epidemic in our country, the epidemic of adolescent sleep deprivation.
Anita Shelgakar wasn't involved in the study. She's a neurologist and president of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. And she has a few steps teens can take to improve their sleep, like dimming the lights and minimizing electronics before bed, keeping a consistent sleep schedule.
Also maintaining a clear sleeping environment, so one that's cool, dark, and quiet.
Shelgakar says adults should model healthy sleep habits and encourage teens to understand that good sleep matters to their overall well-being.
This is certainly a call to action.
And it's one that requires lying down to rise to the occasion. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
For centuries, Black churches in the U.S. have been sanctuaries for not just prayer, but activism, economic uplift, and cultural expression. Preserving this rich legacy is the focus of the Preserving Black Churches program, which awards millions of dollars in funding for capital projects, program development, and organizational planning. Preserving Black Churches, which is sponsored by the National Trust for Historic Preservation, recently announced this year's grantees, and New Jerusalem Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma is one of them. Sean Jarrett is the pastor there, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Aisha, for having me on today.
So let's start with the history of your church. It's affectionately called New J.
Yep.
Am I right that it was founded in the aftermath of the Tulsa race massacre?
That's correct. Our church was founded by a pastor and those founding women and men that came together to reimagine what a Black church could be after such a horrific massacre that destroyed what is known as Greenwood or Black Wall Street. And that was the center of commerce, but also the center of our faith traditions. And as urban renewal came in, which became urban removal for African-American families, many families, most of African Americans, were pushed to North Tulsa. And so in 1957, our church was organized by a founding pastor and a founding group of community members.
And so this is a community that was torn apart by the massacre, but then also by the urban renewal that had been through all of these changes, both the policies and the racial terrorism that happened to them.
Exactly. If you ever come to Tulsa and go to Greenwood, right now there is a highway that runs through what was once a thriving, bustling community. It literally cuts the community off from the rest of the city.
How will the money from the Preserving Black Churches program help New Jay, and how much were you awarded?
We were awarded $200,000 to create an endowment fund for the preservation of our building. Our building where we currently worship in is 70 years old. And so this $200,000 from the Preserving Black Churches grant will be matching dollars for $200,000 that we plan to raise. It will help us not have to make the hard decisions that many Black churches have to make. Do we help someone respond to a community crisis or need, or do we maintain the building? And oftentimes, Black churches throughout America, we've had to make the decision that, yes, we do for our community while our buildings lie in ruin. And so we don't have to make that tough decision now.
Talk to me about the state of Black churches today and the need for this program.
You know, we hear conversations every day about the rising cost in America, right? I think sometimes people think that churches have some kind of magic ATM machine that we go to and withdraw money. And the truth is that we do not. It is becoming increasingly difficult to do ministry in a society where the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer in some ways.
We live in a time now where there is a lot of pushback on this idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion, this idea that you should even have groups, have movements focused on, say, uplifting Black people. And there may be Christians listening saying, well, what does being Black have to do with being Christian? God doesn't see color.
Listen, the African Americans experienced discrimination and were forced out of white churches so that for them to be their full selves, to have the dignity that they deserved, the Black church became necessary for the thriving and survival of African American people in our country. But to be unapologetically Black as a church, it's not to exclude races. Black and brown, but also white and poor people are welcome to come to our congregations.
There are a lot of younger people turning away from church in general, saying it does not meet their needs of today. And they're looking to more spiritualism or other things that are not the traditional Black church. Is that a concern to you?
It is a concern. This idea of I'm spiritual but not religious, I think doesn't just have to do with like this whole de-church movement, but I also think it is trying to figure out what do I do with Christianity because it has been co-opted by Christian nationalism. I pastor in a city that is the buckle of the Bible Belt, where we have mega church pastors who showed up on January 6th marching with flags and crosses, and it has been documented. And I think there is a generation that's trying to decide, I love Jesus, but I don't want that Jesus. And I think the Black church has an opportunity to represent Jesus in such a way that Jesus is on the side of what James Cone says of Black people and those who have been pushed against the walls.
What role do you think that Black churches have in American life moving forward then?
Speak truth to power, to be prophetic, that we have always been at our best when we've been socially conscious, spiritually in tune, really joining those together. They have never been separate in our faith traditions. But secondly, I would say the Black church is still primarily the largest owner of Black land in America. If you lose Black churches, not only do you lose our prophetic witness, but we also lose Black ownership and Black institutions that have ensured that our young people go to school, our young people have access to basic resources and needs. And so what we own, we must continue to make sure we own it and continue to control it because we own it.
That's Pastor Sean Jarrett of New Jerusalem Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Pastor, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. When it comes to school meals, districts have to follow strict standards set by the federal government. But with the release of new dietary guidelines for Americans, those standards may be changing soon. NPR's Caden Mills visited a school in Maryland to see what that could mean for school cafeterias.
With the exception of fresh fruit and vegetables, all the food at Mary H. Matula Elementary School comes frozen or canned.
Everything comes pre-packed. I'll show you here.
Alicia Bassett is the food and nutrition manager at Matula, about an hour south of Washington, D.C. She takes me inside their walk-in freezer.
This is all of our vegetables that we have that are frozen. And then normally I keep what we have for the week here, like cheeseburgers, chicken patties, chicken nuggets.
It's also where they keep things like pizza and pasta, today's lunch entrees. It's 9:30 a.m., and Bassett and her staff are working on lunch.
This is my steamer.
It's where she does most of her cooking.
Put our vegetables in there. Or we'll put our frozen pastas like macaroni and cheese, rotini, and our chili. Those type of meals will go in there.
Matula has prepared meals this way for years, relying on processed foods because, like a lot of schools, that's how its kitchen is set up.
Many schools were built to reheat foods.
That's Lori Nelson of the Chef Ann Foundation, a nonprofit that works on school nutrition.
If a district is not set up to scratch cook, then they're kind of forced in this way to purchase processed items.
But those types of processed foods may soon be in the federal government's crosshairs. New federal dietary guidelines released earlier this year recommend against eating highly processed foods. Here's Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announcing the new guidelines.
Highly processed foods loaded with additives, added sugar, and excess salt damage health and should be avoided.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture sets school nutrition standards based on those dietary guidelines, which means schools like Matula may soon have to revisit their reliance on heat and serve meals and cook more from scratch instead. What would it take for Bassett to do that at Matula?
I would need probably a 12-hour day instead of an 8-hour day.
So a lot more time and also more trained staff. Schools across the country face similar challenges.
They simply do not have the money, the staff, the equipment to be able to prepare all of their meals from scratch.
That's Diane Pratt-Hevner, a spokesperson for the School Nutrition Association. She said school food companies have already been working to develop healthier recipes, and they've actually made a lot of progress.
There's research showing school meals are the healthiest meals that Americans are eating today.
The new guidelines could push school meals to be even healthier, but Nelson of the Chef Ann Foundation said it'll take time.
You cannot go from serving heavily processed heat and serve items to scratch cooking immediately.
It's a transition, one that involves training staff, updating kitchens, and changing how schools buy food. Pratt-Hevner said those changes will likely be costly.
Schools will definitely need an increase in funds to make that kind of change.
The release of new dietary guidelines won't bring immediate changes to school meals. It's just the first step in a process that could take years. As for Matula Elementary School, they'll take the changes as they come. For now, they've got mouths to feed. Caden Mills, NPR News, La Plata, Maryland.
You're listening to NPR News.
If you are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio, my name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. iLink Minnesota helps those with vision loss move forward with technology-based solutions. Your donation can bring hope and independence. Learn more by searching for iLink Minnesota online. That's the word I, spelled E-Y-E. If you provide childcare for a friend or family member, there are educational resources and supplies available through the Indigenous nonprofit All Nations Rise. Items include books, trainings, first aid kits, and more. Learn more at allnationsrise.com/FFN. Now back to Weekend Edition.
I'm Louise Schiavone with these headlines. Iran has fired more drones and rockets at Israel, Kuwait, and other Gulf states on the ninth day of the war. At least two large fires were seen in Kuwait. A desalinization facility was hit in Bahrain. Israel today launched a new wave of strikes in the region, hitting oil storage facilities in Tehran and Hezbollah sites in southern Lebanon. In a post on his Truth social media platform, President Trump vowed to continue to target Iranian officials. China's foreign minister Wang Yi says the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran should not have happened and that it does no one any good. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
I am great. How are you, Aisha?
Good. Now, Will, please remind us of last week's challenge.
Yes, it came from Andrea Carla Michaels of San Francisco. I said, name a famous 20th century writer, remove the last two letters of the first name and the last letter of the last name, and the result will name a clothing material. Well, the author is Virginia Woolf. Drop those letters and you get virgin wool.
There were more than 900 correct entries this week, and last week's puzzle winner answered the puzzle in the studio. Like, he knew it immediately. And so that's why we was like, oh my goodness, you're going to be on here a fourth time, but he didn't make it this time. This week's winner is Wesley Davis of Black Mountain, North Carolina. Congratulations, Wesley.
Thank you.
So how did you figure out this week's answer?
My first hunch was actually Ayn Rand and Aran, the fabric from the islands of off Ireland. And I wasn't fully satisfied, so then I landed on the intended answer of Virginia Woolf.
Now, how long have you been playing the puzzle? Because this is your first time. You're not a repeat offender here.
Correct, yes. I've been playing the puzzle pretty religiously for almost a decade, so I'm was so excited to get the call.
What do you do when you're not playing the puzzle?
I'm a mental health counselor. Outside of that, I love anything outdoors. I have a 12-year-old son, Henry. I've got a shout out to him, and he enjoys trying to solve the puzzle with me as well.
So he'll be coming up here next.
I hope so.
He'll be a future player on the air.
I got to ask you, are you ready to play the puzzle?
I'm not great with rapid-fire puzzles, the on-air, but let's give it a go.
You don't know until you try it. You never know.
That's right. That's what I tell patients.
Exactly. Take it away, Will.
So this is a quiet puzzle. Every answer is a word that starts with S-H. I'm going to give you two words that the answer can precede in order to complete compound words or familiar two-word phrases. You tell me the S-H word. For example, if I said holder and cropper, you would say share, as in shareholder and sharecropper. Your first one is shooter and eyed, E-Y-E-D. What word precedes shooter and eyed?
Sharp.
Sharp shooter and sharp eyed. Good job. Music, metal.
Sheet.
Sheet music and sheet metal. Nice. Skin, dog.
Sheep.
Sheepskin and sheepdog is correct. Shocked game. Give you a hint, this starts S-H.
Shell.
shell-shocked and shell-game, good. Key, gears.
Shift.
Shift key and shift gears is right. Wreck, mate.
Ship.
Shipwreck, shipmate, yes. Horn, lace.
Sheep, no. Shoelace.
Shoelace and shoehorn is right. Center, list.
Short, no.
Where do you go to buy things?
Shop, shop.
Yeah?
Oh, shop, shopping, shopping.
Shopping, center, and shopping list is right. Change, range.
Short change, short range.
That's it. Clock, glass.
It's like when you're at the bar and you're throwing them back.
Oh, shot clock. Yeah, my son would get that one.
How about blade, strap?
Switch. No.
It's part of the body.
Oh, shoulder.
Shoulder blade and shoulder strap is right. Stall, curtain.
Shower.
Nice job, Wesley.
You said you weren't good with rapid fire, but you did a wonderful job.
I faded about halfway through. Oh, my gosh.
No. Some of these are tough. These are tough ones. So how do you feel?
I feel grateful and a bit humbled.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Wesley, what member station do you listen to?
I'm an alternate support between 88.1 Blue Ridge Public Radio and 88.7 WNCW.
That's Wesley Davis of Black Mountain, North Carolina. Thank you so much for playing the puzzle.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Don DeMichelle of Redlands, California. Name a famous musical duo. Remove four consecutive letters of the duo's name, and phonetically you'll name a famous non-musical duo. Who are they? So again, a famous musical duo. Remove four consecutive letters, and phonetically, you'll name a famous non-musical duo. What groups are these?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, to submit your response. Just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, March 12th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, file under You're Doing It Wrong, a strategy many of us have used, trying to strengthen our kids' willpower by using junk food or screen time as a reward. Well, social scientists say that strategy doesn't work. In fact, they say it increases unhealthy habits. And there's a better way.
You can truly learn to like the things that are good for you.
Like salmon, roasted broccoli, reading actual books. Offer these options like they're the greatest things ever.
Your kids' choices are malleable, and it's really influenced in part by what they're exposed to.
Hear all about this research tomorrow on Morning Edition. Tell your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. British author Lizzie Pook is known for historical fiction, but there's another subgenre that's fascinated her for a long time, even back in college. That's when she told her university advisor that she wanted to do her dissertation on serial killers.
And he was absolutely appalled. You know, he was really worried for my well-being. He made me promise in writing not to contact any serial killers in prison.
2 decades later, Lizzie Pook is more interested in the women who never suspected their husbands were gruesome killers. Her new novel, written under the pen name Elizabeth Arnett, is a thriller set in 1960s California called The Secret Lives of Murderers' Wives.
Criminals' Wives, victims of their husband's indiscretions, sometimes had a certain look. Margot could see it in newspaper articles and rolling coverage on the TV. Especially those wives who loyally followed their husbands to court, adamant that their Joe, Bob, Frank could never be responsible for such abominable acts. He was such a kind man, they'd parrot in interviews after trials that laid out in scrupulous, incontestable detail how their husbands had slaughtered multiple people. He never raised a fist at home. We're not simpering wives. We learned the truth. We got mad. We moved on, says Margot. Is this really moving on? Beverly asks doubtfully. I just had to relive everything in front of a room full of cops. Well, I'm drinking cocktails at 2:30 in the afternoon. I've moved on, Margot replies. I made melon balls, Elsie shrugs weakly.
The three characters in the book, they found each other after their husband's crimes were uncovered, and they kind of have this friendship, but it's also like a support group. Can you tell us first about Margot and Elsie?
Yeah, so these women are part of a club that nobody wants to be part of. Elsie, she's trying to work her way up in a newsroom. She's never really listened to, but she's very tenacious. She has reacted to her husband's crimes with action, momentum. You know, she's seeking out facts at every opportunity. So she sort of arms herself with knowledge so that it won't happen to her again. And then you have Margot. She loves a Hollywood studio party. She loves dressing up and drinking and sort of putting on a show and a facade. And she wants to be seen as to not care about what happened to her. But really, deep down, she is very fragile, very vulnerable and damaged by what has happened.
And tell us about Beverly, because she seems completely shaken to her core. She's the only one of them that's a mother. How is she coping?
Beverly, or Bev, is the one character who is really struggling with the duality of the man that she lived with and loved. She finds it very difficult to see the father of her children as a monster. She knows what he has done is terrible. And she has a son, and she's terrified that her son might have inherited the same rotten core as her husband.
As the women are moving forward with their lives, they become aware of a series of suspicious deaths of several women in the town. And their, you know, the spidey senses start tingling. Like, they realize something is going on, but they seem more determined to investigate these crimes than the police. Why is that?
Well, I do think they want to stop it happening to other women, and they want to atone. The FBI's behavioral science unit was set up in the early 1970s. I thought, you know, wouldn't it be funny, a little joke to women, a little joke to myself, to have, you know, three housewives sort of beating them at their game and scooping the FBI's behavioral science unit and starting to profile these sorts of men, because they've lived through it. They, in hindsight, can see the signs. But also, mid-1960s was a time where in some states, women weren't allowed to serve on juries because it was thought that they were too fragile, too sensitive, and too compassionate to be objective. And law enforcement would have probably held those same views, you know, that they were too fragile and compassionate to be able to solve these crimes. But I sort of wanted to give them a chance to get one over on them.
Well, you know, and I'm not going to give anything away, because it is very twisty as they try to stop this killer. But, you know, something that comes up is that as women, you don't really know where the danger is going to come from. I mean, it could be from a stranger, but often it is from a loved one. And you also have to kind of always be vigilant. And that's a hard way to live. But do you think that's why so many women are into true crime?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right there. I think part of our fascination with true crime as women, and it is a genre that many women are drawn to, part of that is about knowing the beast, getting all the information that we can about something that poses a risk to us, because we are so used to having to plan every step of our lives with a sort of risk assessment. I think we are comforted by true crime stories, there's very often a female victim at the beginning, and then there's an investigation, and then there is closure and justice. And so I do think we find comfort in that.
And all three of these women are dealing with shame, with guilt for the actions of their husbands, which, I mean, they weren't a part of it, but they are kind of carrying it, right? What did you want to examine about that shame that can often come on women because of the actions of the men in their lives?
Well, I do think it's very interesting that the one question that we often think of, and I say this because I thought it too, how can they not have known? And when I started writing this book, I actually do think that I held a small amount of judgment. You know, I thought they didn't know, but I would definitely know. If I was in that situation, I'm sure I'd know. I'm sure there would be something that would give it away. But actually, if you do look at the stories of real women who have been through this, they didn't know. You know, they couldn't have known, because forensic psychologists or experts who deal with serial killers, they will tell you that most often serial killers are so skilled at manipulation, so skilled at control, it is almost impossible to know what they're hiding.
And so you want people to come away from reading this novel to have more sympathy and compassion, not just for serial killers' wives, but just to have compassion for women in general who may be caught up in these sorts of situations.
Absolutely. And I think it's also possibly acknowledging that the very same thing could happen to us. There were serial killers' wives who were attorneys. You know, I've spoken to women whose husbands had affairs, and they were so, so, so shocked that they couldn't see what was going on, that there was no clue. They always thought that they would have an inkling. But anyone is vulnerable to being controlled, to being manipulated, no matter your background or intelligence level. You know, that is just part of being a human. So yes, compassion, yes, empathy, and yes, the sort of understanding that this can really happen to anyone.
That's Elizabeth Arnett. Her new novel is The Secret Lives of Murderers' Wives. Thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. To find out more about the books and authors you hear on NPR's programs, go to npr.org/books. There you'll find author interviews, NPR's bestseller lists, and find out what our staff is reading.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, sailing to over 250 destinations on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne. Committed to providing White Star service and enrichment opportunities. Cunard.com. And from Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word DONATE to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Tickets are now available for United Way of Northeastern Minnesota's Flavor of the North event, April 23rd at Range Recreation and Civic Center in Eveleth. Funds support the Buddy Backpack Program, providing food to children who are at risk of going hungry while not in school. Find tickets at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The University of Minnesota Climate Adaption Partnership, the Initiative Foundation, and Happy Dancing Turtle are co-hosting the Community Climate Leaders Program with four in-person sessions in Pine River and an online curriculum. Find more information at z.umn.edu/climateleader. Registration is due by March 16th. Hope Community Presbyterian Church in Virginia has an uplifting concert Sunday, March 8th at 3 p.m. to raise funds for a new lift for their 103-year-old building. Vocal jazz octet, The Sectionals, will perform with organist Vicky Gornick.